From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, January 18th, 2017. And on this day, the secret behind Governor Paul LePage's weight loss is out, and it's bariatric surgery. And people on two of Maine's remote Down East Islands won't be allowed to switch their electric service to Emera. We'll look at what that could mean. That's all ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
The residents of two remote Down East Islands, Frenchboro and Swan's Island, pay some of the highest electric bills in the nation. They had asked to abandon their local electric cooperative to join with the mainland customers of a large utility who enjoy cheaper distribution rates. But state regulators rebuffed that request today. They say Emera Maine's customers should not be stuck with the island's extra costs. Some say that decision sets a new precedent that could drive up electricity costs on many of the state's islands and in inland rural areas as well. Fred Bever has more.
A total of about 390 people live year-round on the two islands, some 20 miles southwest of Acadia National Park. Their electricity comes via undersea cable, and its distribution is handled by Swan's Island Electric Cooperative. Founded in 1949, the co-op is the sixth smallest in the country, according to President Ed Schwabe.
We have a couple of Eskimo settlements in Alaska that are smaller than us, and an Indian reservation or two out in Arizona and in the Dakotas that are smaller than us. But we are tiny, and we are paying some of the highest electric rates anywhere in the state.
It's not the electricity itself that costs so much more. The islands pay the same as mainland residents for the actual electrons. It's the cost of delivery. While the typical monthly bill for delivery to a mainland Emera customer falls around $50, it's $108 to $128 a month for the islanders. Last year, co-op members voted to seek state permission to dissolve the organization and sell its assets and customer base to Emera. That's even though that meant giving up on a valued institution and the local services it provided to its independent-minded customers.
In spite of giving up the independence of having their own electric company, the jobs that came with it, and the knowledge that we may have some long durations in the winter storm without power, 91% of our members stepped forward and said, We need some relief from the high rates that we're paying.
The co-op, Emera, and the state public advocate, who was charged with protecting the interests of all state electricity customers, all agreed that Emera should buy out the co-op. There would be a roughly $400,000 annual cost to Emera customers, but the parties agreed that spread out over Emera's much larger customer base, that was a small per-person price to pay to ease a disproportionate burden on the island residents. And when you lump all those island and mainland customers together, they reasoned, economies of scale will result, fewer employees needed, unified administration, maintenance, and billing costs that bring the overall expenses down. But then, the Public Utilities Commission weighed in.
Well, people choose to live on Swan's Island. They managed to live with high oil and high fuel prices in the past. Everything costs more than it does on the mainland, and it always has. And we learn in Real Estate 101 that you pay for location.
That's Bruce Williamson, an economist and member of the three-person panel appointed by Governor Paul LePage. He argued that the benefits of averaging costs over the larger customer base do not trump the principle of allocating costs to those that incur them. In this case, far-flung island residents who decided to live away from the more densely populated and cheaper to serve mainland.
In my view, the entire uniform rates, rate averaging concept having precedential value in Maine is a fabrication and a principle of mere convenience. And it's also used to sweep away objections that the real equity principle, that of the generally accepted principle of cost causality, is unnecessary.
Williamson also suggested that the public advocate, Tim Schneider, was abandoning his obligation to protect Emera's many ratepayers in favor of the comparative handful of islanders involved. But after the commission voted 2-1 to reject the deal, Schneider held his ground, saying the commission's position was troubling.
Going down the road, I think we need to decide whether this is an appropriate role for the commission to charge people more based on where they live within the state. And that obviously has implications for where people choose to live and you know, what our state looks like going forward.
Schneider's not the only one who thinks the commission is setting a new and possibly wrong-headed precedent.
It's not a small thing to open the gates to this discussion.
Suzanne McDonald is Community Energy Director for the Island Institute.
We have many different examples across the state with other electricity service, with phone service, with internet service, where we see that sharing of cost across geographic areas because so much of our state is rural.
The commissioners and the parties say there's still room for a new proposal that would put fewer costs on Emera's existing customers. One commissioner called it a glide path. But in the meantime, residents of the two islands will likely have to endure another winter paying electricity bills that, according to the federal government, are some of the highest in the country. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
The secret behind Governor Paul LePage's weight loss is out. LePage recently revealed on local talk radio that both he and his wife Anne underwent bariatric surgery to lose weight. An article in today's Twin City Times by Governor LePage's Director of Communications, Peter Steele, says the LePages had a procedure called sleeve gastrectomy. Patty White reports on how it's done and why it helps people lose weight.
According to Steele's article, Governor LePage had the surgery in September at Central Maine Medical Center because he was afraid of losing his feet due to the risk of diabetes-related circulation problems. Diabetes runs in LePage's family, and he had been diagnosed with prediabetes. Anne LePage had the procedure in December after struggling with weight for most of her life. They're among a growing number of Mainers who are electing for bariatric weight loss surgery, according to the director of surgical weight loss at Eastern Maine Medical Center, Dr. Michelle Toder.
I think in Maine there are probably upwards of 500 or 600 weight loss operations performed a year.
Toder says this is just the tip of the iceberg, about 1% of people who actually medically qualify for weight loss surgery. According to the Cleveland Clinic, the average cost of bariatric surgery is about $20,000. Toder says most insurers cover these procedures for people who meet appropriate criteria, but many patients are reluctant because they think it's too extreme or that they should be able to lose weight on their own. But for some, says Toder, surgery is a necessary tool.
We're not talking about someone who needs to lose 20 or 30 pounds. We're talking about people with body mass indices at 35 to 40, that are 75 to 100 pounds or more overweight. That population has been studied over and over and over again. And the vast majority, greater than 90% of those people, will lose weight with behavioral change but can't sustain it.
According to the Steele article, the LePages had tried different exercise and eating regimens over the years, but always gained back the weight they lost. Bariatric nurse practitioner Catherine LaPointe of Maine Medical Center says sleeve gastrectomies help achieve sustained weight loss because the procedure removes the large, stretchy part of the stomach that allows us to eat more and leaves behind a skinny tube or sleeve.
It's a restrictive procedure because about 80% of the stomach is permanently removed. Most people will feel really satisfied after eating a very small amount of food.
Removing part of the stomach also produces a hormonal effect, which helps suppress appetite.
Because it's a very complex mechanism, we don't fully understand it, but we do know that it's an incredibly powerful tool.
But this tool, says LaPointe, must be used in conjunction with a weight management program. Before surgery, patients work with specialists to make lifestyle changes.
And if you can give the tools of behavior management, change in habits, proper eating style, and mindful eating techniques, and you can get the patient through a surgical procedure to get the weight off, they generally, if they stay with the program, will keep the weight off lifelong.
Though there are risks with sleeve gastrectomies, such as blood clots, bleeding, and leaching from the staple line, the weight loss can alleviate other health issues. According to Steele, Governor LePage's blood pressure and cholesterol levels have improved since the procedure, as has his back pain. And apparently, the governor dug out of his closet a 25-year-old tuxedo that hasn't fit in years, that he can now wear to President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
College Republicans feel more frozen out than usual. Next week, Republicans will have a firm grip on power in Washington, but on traditionally liberal college campuses in New England, Republican students say they feel, as I said, more frozen out of the political conversation than they ever have before. Reporter Sean Tian has the story.
During the presidential campaign, whiteboards outside some dorm rooms at Clark University in Worcester were covered with pro-Hillary Clinton messages. So freshman Faith Whitcoast used hers to talk up Donald Trump. That wasn't a problem until Trump's victory.
I did wake up the next morning after election results came out with some profanities written all across my board, and I don't know to this day who did it.
Whitcoast is one of many politically conservative college students across Massachusetts who say they've felt increasingly uncomfortable expressing their views, as election anger is sometimes aimed at them. Teresa Meyer is co-president of the Republican Club at Smith College in Northampton. She says expressing conservative views on campus was difficult even before the election.
We are often faced with direct attacks in classes. If you speak publicly about it, your name will end up on Facebook or on Twitter. And, you know, it's not a comfortable position to be in. Nobody wants to be the girl that you walk into the dining hall and everybody hates you.
I mean, I'm sorry that they feel that way. I don't think personal insults are ever really appropriate or professional.
That's Nina Henry. She's a college Democrat at Smith.
But I do think there are a lot of students who are going to be targeted under a Trump presidency for their sexuality, for their religion, for their immigration status. And I think those are the people we need to be worried about right now.
Worried in part because since the election, police departments across the country have reported sharp increases in crimes motivated by race, ethnicity, and religion. There's no reason to think that the backlash on campus experienced by college Republicans has reached that level, says Ben Rajadurai. He's a senior at Stonehill College in Easton and chairman of the Massachusetts Alliance of College Republicans.
It was a very, very angry and divisive election, and now I guess it's time for everyone to unite and come back together, and that's all we can do at this point.
But that's not happening yet, Rajadurai says, and he feels animosity toward Republicans on campus has hindered debate and, it appears, friendships. Joelle Krause is a college Republican at Clark.
I had two friends in particular that literally didn't talk to me for like a week after the election.
Krause also felt alienated by Clark's administration. She met with the university president after he sent an email offering support to students upset by the election.
I had some really valid fears of mine that if the election had gone the other way, I would have been incredibly afraid of. And I don't think I told him like those wouldn't have been addressed had the election come out the other way.
Our response was not to the election result. It was really to some of the concerns that had been triggered.
That's David Angel, Clark's president. He defends the email, saying it was meant to be a message of caring to those in fear after the election.
It was the vulnerability of members of our community, largely in response to the way in which this election unfolded itself.
Angel says administrators and faculty at Clark are brainstorming ways to get students of all viewpoints talking. Unless they can create a climate of respect and inclusion, he says students could pull back from the kinds of conversations that are so important in college. On that point, at least, he and college Republicans agree. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Sean Tian.
And that's This Day in Maine, Wednesday, January 18th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin, Keith Shortall, and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.